Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. Welcome to another episode of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook, and as always, I will be your host today. Today, we are joined by another special guest, the amazing Rebecca Adams. Woo!
Hi!
Welcome, Rebecca. Thank you for joining us on the podcast today. Now, Rebecca Adams, if you don't know, is an archivist at the Cadbury Research Library Special Collections at the University of Birmingham, and they're responsible for the Stuart Hall Archive Collection. She works alongside Patricia Noxolo, Nick Beach, Rebecca Roach, Catherine Parsons, and Rita Gale on a very specific Stuart Hall archiving project. She previously worked at the London Metropolitan Archives, which is now the London Archives in Farringdon, where she was the project archivist responsible for the Africa Centre collection and the Molly Hunt collection, two really important collections. She was also part of the International Council on Archives New Professional Programme 2022 to 2023. Her key interests stem from her Afro-Caribbean background, which include decolonising archives, community archives, archival representation, access, and the work of Black archivists in the UK. Rebecca has also provided a chapter which was published in New Histories of African and Caribbean People in Britain, edited by Hakeem Adi and published in 2023, also known as Many Struggles, the title of the book of which that collection was a part of. And I'm sure, as you can imagine, today we're going to be talking about all the kind of things archiving, the world of archives, Molly Hunt, the educational psychologist, education, psychology, all the good things. So this episode is one for those of you teachers out there, I'm sure, those of you interested in archiving and those generally that just like Black British history, the regular listeners. Okay, Rebecca, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
No worries, thanks for joining me. I thought we'll start just to, you know, let the listeners get to know a bit about you, and then we can talk about your work and some of the like interesting things that you do and have found out in your work. And firstly, kind of what piqued your interest or what got you interested in Black history or history more broadly?
Well, when it comes to kind of thinking about history more broadly, I was actually thinking about this question, and I was like, so what actually started this? And it actually went right back to like primary school. And I remember one of the little like kind of school trips, but not really school trips, was actually us going down the road past our school, because I went to school in Sydenham, and going to like on the high street and looking at shop fronts. Because some of the shop fronts had like kind of disintegrated, and you could see kind of the histories that kind of what the shop fronts used to be behind the signs. And I remember one of the old shop signs was like J. Sainsbury's. I remember our teacher just saying, yeah, you know, these shops, they used to, you know, be something else before you were born and before maybe your parents were born. They were a different kind of shop. Maybe they were a different supermarket, that kind of thing. And I remember, you know, I don't know how, 6 or 7, I was like, oh my gosh, things happened before I was born. The people did things before I was born. I was like, oh my God, that's crazy. It's so different. And then when I was in secondary school, we did a project about like our house. So like the history of where we actually live. And I remember I went to the library with my mum, and because I used to love going to the library as a child anyway. I did a lot of reading. And we ended up looking at a book which had like old pictures of our road. And in the book that, you know, our road was literally just forest. Right. And there's a pub near our house that was also kind of still there. And this was must have been like the 1890s. And I remember looking at it and thinking, yeah, I'm very much enjoying history right now. Like history is something that I really enjoy. So, and that kind of piqued my interest in kind of history broadly. In terms of Black British history, it was more so just about, I just wanted to learn about my own community, really. I wanted to learn about the people who came before me, because I realised I didn't actually know that much, really. I mean, what I was taught in schools, it was literally slavery and then civil rights movement. And there was nothing about Black British history, Black British figures, and anything that was kind of positive in some ways in terms of what Black British people kind of, the hand that they had in a kind of shaping British culture. So I think that was also kind of part of it for me. I was just like, you know what, no one's going to teach this to me. I'm going to have to go out there and try and find it myself.
That's a realisation a lot of us had, that kind of do this work now that, you know, there isn't really a place for us, or in an academic setting anyway.
Definitely. And I did a module at university, because I went to Goldsmiths, and it was my final year module, and it was Caribbean women writers, and it was with Joan Animado. Love Joan. Shout out to Joan. And there I kind of learned more about kind of, you know, the Caribbean, different islands in the Caribbean, more about Caribbean writers from the Caribbean, especially women. And that also started kind of my trajectory towards thinking more about history and migration and those kind of things.
Nice. How did you get into then becoming an archivist, like obviously doing... I'm assuming you did literature then?
Yes.
History, literature?
So I did a joint degree. I did English and history. I don't actually think they do it at Goldsmiths anymore, wasn't actually that many of us doing it at the time, but I kind of did a joint degree and then realised in my final year that I was like, actually I'm kind of leaning more towards history. English is okay, but history is kind of where it's at for me, so
absolutely.
And then, I mean, in terms of your question about kind of how I got into kind of archiving, how I became an archivist, it was once again thanks to Goldsmiths. In my second year, we did a module called History at Work. And I remember I saw it in my first year as like one of the options. And I remember saying, I am going to do that module, because it was outside of the university. You basically went to a museum or an archive somewhere in London, and you would do like a little project there. You'd do some time where you would like volunteer there basically for like 6 weeks. And then right at the end, you'd write an essay or about something that you learnt there or about something that you want to research. So I ended up going to the London Metropolitan Archives, now the London Archives. And that was kind of my first time realising that there was actually a strong Black presence within archives, especially London archives, because I did a whole project on the Huntleys, Jessica and Eric Huntley, and I ended up writing a whole kind of research essay about the International Radical Black Books Book Fair that they had over various time period. I can't remember the times, but I can't, not right now, but I kind of did it looking at kind of archive representation, heritage, and kind of thinking about solidarity and how looking at Black archives can kind of change our perception of how we see ourselves and general history. And that really cemented for me, and I was like, I want to do what the people do here in terms of sorting out this archive. And that's when I kind of searched around for places to volunteer. I volunteered at the George Padmore Institute, and I did a few local projects where I volunteered at the archives in Lewisham. And I just kind of just trying to get more experience and kind of get more of a hold on different Black archives in London. And that was when I said, okay, I didn't know what an archivist was 2 years ago. Now I do. Now I have to go and do the course and become an actual archivist and train to be an archivist,
yeah.
Which I did at University College London. And yeah, and that's kind of actually being a, kind of a researcher in an archive and kind of getting that yeah. kind of perspective, that kind of really started my journey on kind of going, okay, I'm going to be an archivist. That is what I'm going to do. Mm. And I also think a lot of it's to do with my mum has always been a kind of, she's always said to me, Rebecca, specialise in something. And I was like, and I remember when I was younger, I was like, I don't really know what you mean. But now I kind of have a better idea, because she was like, you need to find, you know, a niche. You need to find a job that people will always need or always kind of want or always kind of has a space for you. And so I kind of feel like it was very much her influence also kind of brought me into archives and thinking about archives specifically and becoming an archivist.
Amazing. Yeah, I guess a lot of people's kind of life mission is to find the thing they're interested in and then a kind of career that fits that. And it, because I hate when people say like, oh, if you like love your job, like it doesn't feel like you're working. No, it does. It's
exactly. It's still, I'm still working. I still want to get paid.
It still work. Yeah, exactly. As you know, your mom rightly pointed out, like, you specialise in, A, it gives you something to kind of, like, doing the master's and pushing through the kind of archiving ladder. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that ladder looks like, but I'm sure there's one.
Yep.
But especially within the field where we know it's so, like, underserved, you wrote in your Many Struggles chapter, which is in Hakeem Adi's, like, edited collection. Mm-hmm. It's Many Struggles, New Histories of African and Caribbean People in Britain, which I've spoken about on this podcast before. But you were talking about the fact that there are, I think there was, like, four archives dedicated to like black women in Britain at the time where you found Molly Hunt's collection was donated. So not that you just look at women now in Britain, but how have you kind of seen the like field develop, or what does it look like? You know, how well served are black people in these archives?
I wouldn't say well. It's definitely better than it used to be. But, yeah. I mean, it's those kind of things where it could always be better. Yeah. I definitely think there's been a shift. I think when it comes to thinking about archives and when it comes to thinking about archives that are actually, you know, deposited at specific institutions, a lot of the time it can very much be about who's important, whose society has deemed to be an important person in order to say, okay, your archive is important, let's take it, let's sort it out, let's make sure it's accessible. But I will say there's definitely been, I've seen more, especially black women, and I definitely think the community has a lot to do with it, where they've kind of encouraged a lot of people who may not feel that their archive or kind of their own personal history is something that should be donated to an archive. And actually, there's been quite a big shift. Like, for example, since I wrote the chapter, actually, there's been, you know, quite a few more archives that have been donated to various places or acquired by various institutions. The archive that comes to mind off the top of my head is Andrea Levy's archive at the British Library, and I'm sure there are multiple others, but for the life of me I can't think of it at the top of my head. But it's slowly changing, and I also think a lot of it is to do with the fact that kind of we all know that once your archive is actually placed in an institution, it will hopefully, whether it's used or not, it's still there to be preserved, right?
Absolutely.
And it's still going to be there, hopefully, you know, in 50-100 years, you know, whether the institution wants it there or not. right?
Mm.
And I think that's also something that's really important when thinking about archives and thinking about, and also to your viewers in general, like, we can't think that only important people deserve to have their archives donated. We need to be able to also have a collective memory of our own communities in general. Like, you as an individual might not feel that your archive is very important, but I'm sure if you were to get your archive with you know, a few other people who also helped you or worked with you or whatever, and you put it together, it would be something of such importance that people really likely want to see.
Absolutely, it is very true. I don't like histories of quote-unquote important people. Mm-hmm. I find them a bit boring. Yeah. I think, and especially like you started talking about your primary school experience of history. Mm-hmm. You know, history at that level is all about world building.
Yeah.
For young children, is understanding what Britain looked like in the yeah. Victorian yeah. era or this era, and ordinary people tell that story. It's why you go to places like the Black Country Living Museum when you're mm-hmm. younger, because you can see what this village or this town would have mm-hmm. looked like, you know. So I think the histories of the average nurse or teacher or yeah. you know, activist is just as important mm-hmm. if they're famous or not, mm-hmm. you know, as the big names where we can glean different kinds of information mm-hmm. from. So I wanted you to tell us a little bit more about Molly Hunt, because I'll be honest, it's not someone I knew anything about before reading Many Struggles, and before, well, your introduction given to like us in this chapter about Molly, and I know that you've worked quite closely with her archives through the research you've done and, you know, your archiving work as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, if you want to tell us a bit about her, what does she do and how she kind of has inspired your research, or why you decided to focus work on her.
Molly Hunt was the first ever archive I worked on once from finishing the archives and records management course. So it holds a very special place in my heart.
Yeah, of course.
As in the collection, there was about 170 boxes of her wow. life, basically, where an archivist had basically gone. She was born in 1932 in Guyana, and she passed away in 2015. And her archives were deposited at the London Archives in 2016, 2017. And then I was put in post in 2018. So archivists had come in after her passing and kind of just seen things that seemed interesting and put them in boxes.
Yeah.
And I was tasked with looking through all these boxes and making sense of them, putting them in some kind of order, and then cataloguing and making them accessible to the general public. I also didn't know who she was, so I had to basically create like a timeline, a family tree, her history, basically, from her archives. So she came to the UK in 1961. She was originally a teacher in Guyana, and she came over to the UK to continue her her further education. And she didn't necessarily have the means to be able to get herself through the various avenues and various degrees that she would have to get through to become eventually an education psychologist. So she also taught at various schools in London, mostly special schools, and used that money that she made from that to fund her higher education. So she did a huge amount of different. She went to a large amount of different universities. Basically, she went to the University of Birmingham. She went to the Northeast London Polytechnic. She went to multiple places, yeah. multiple places. And then eventually in the 1970s, she got kind of qualified as a education psychologist. And she was one of the one of two, actually, black female education psychologists alongside Waveney Bushell. And she was just so important to her community. She was good friends with other activists and educators of the time period, such as Willis Wilkie and Winston Best. She was friends with the Eric and Jessica Huntley. She co-founded a number of organisations to advocate for Caribbean families. So obviously at the time, 70s and 80s, it was very common for young black children, especially children who had come straight from different islands in the Caribbean, to be sent to what was termed then educationally subnormal schools, or what we would term now as special schools, special educational needs schools. And black children were disproportionately being sent there because, you know, they would come over from the Caribbean, usually with an accent. They'd usually, they might be in different years in the Caribbean compared to the UK. And rather than actually work with the children and the families to be able to understand the different education systems, they would just go, well, this child clearly isn't smart enough, and they would send them to education subnormal schools. And Molly was basically the advocate to kind of go into those schools and help those parents and say, actually, this child doesn't need to go to this special school. This child just needs, you know, maybe, you know, extra attention, needs to, we need to, you know, potentially give them a statement, talk to them, you know, understand their academic attainment, those kind of things. And she would kind of, and she would also go to the families and kind of explain to them how the UK education system differs from that of you know, the Caribbean, various islands in the Caribbean. So she was a very, very important person who was actually really behind the families and the children to really advocate for them, because she really understood the education system for what it was. And she set up co-founded the Caribbean Parents Group, which were in the 1970s, which is an advocacy group for black parents and children. But they also had trips, like annual trips that they would go on. They would have Christmas parties, they would, you know, have meetings and create conferences on various issues, such as, you know, youth attainment and elderly care and all these kind of things. And then through that, a supplementary school was also created, which taught kind of English and maths and helped with kind of personal statements and all those kind of things for young people. And then there was the Caribbean Parents Group Credit Union that was set up in the 1990s, to help with funding, to help with savings within the actual Caribbean Parents Group members. And that Molly Hunt set up a huge number of organisations, but I'm just going to go for the last two, really. And there was the West Vee Academy, which was predominantly for teacher training. So teacher training to think about training teachers in different ways when thinking about how to interact with different communities, and also to help young children thinking about CVs, personal statements, further education, and kind of that's kind of the main organization's remit. And that was set up in the 1980s. And then finally, the PEV consultancy that Molly set up herself, which was an educational, a therapy consultancy, basically, for young people who, and adults what I found in the archives is that predominantly adults who went to the consultancy, who when they were younger weren't supported for various reasons around their neurodivergence. For example, so they might have had dyslexia or ADHD or autism, and they may not have been diagnosed when they were younger for a variety of reasons. It could be prejudice or just general problems with the schools, for example. And so they would go to Molly, you know, as adults and say, you know, I feel like maybe I have this or I have that, and would you be able to actually go through this with me, potentially help me with, you know, organizations I should reach out to, you know, do I need to be tested for various things? And kind of Molly would kind of walk them through that, and you can see in the archives that people were so grateful, because, you know, these were adults in their 30s, 40s, 50s who had struggled with various with various things, and that it just never necessarily popped up or been highlighted for them throughout their life. And now they'd come to Molly and they were like, you know what, actually I think I need you know, I need some guidance. And I think Molly Hunt was really, really important in that way. So yeah, she did everything and anything, honestly. Yeah. If I actually explained all the different things she did, I think we'd probably be here for 2 hours, yeah, to be quite honest.
Maybe
with
2 weeks.
You.
Yeah. Honestly, it sounds like she really lived a full life, to say the least. But it kind of then strikes me as like, not scary, but scary at the fact that, you know, she did so much. And, you know, in my research, I look at education a lot. And a lot of the issues that children were having, I think, as much as them stemming from like a racist institution and a racist Britain, were also coming from a parent's lack of knowledge and understanding of the system, and an understanding or a belief that it was similar to the system back home, and it completely was not. And I think the fact that Molly Hunt was even just doing that work on like a parental level to kind of educate people in the community to say, actually, teachers aren't doing this, they don't care about this, they're not checking for this, you have to be on their toes for that. Like,
yeah,
that is so important. And it's interesting, even within my research doing oral history, of the children who are now adults, obviously, saying, you know, their parents had a grasp of education, so we were able to achieve X, Y, Z,
mm-hmm,
compared to our parents didn't know the system until it was too late, and, mm-hmm, and we, you know, had to then go to night school or do our qualifications,
yeah,
later on.
Yeah.
It's so interesting that, mm-hmm, Molly Hunt kind of she clocked onto that,
yeah,
and knew and understood and 100%. Actually did something, not just to help her own, you know, local community, people in her life, family, whatever, but actually the broader community. And I think that generation was so good at community organising and looking, yes, out for each other. I wish we had it more now, but it is obviously nice to read about and work about her. That being said, we know all this stuff now from you and me. Well, not really me. I just gave my little sentence. But why then is Molly Hunt not a name that we know? Why isn't her name not, you know, rolling off the tongue? Why do we not see her in the Black British history conversations? Because she really is, I think, a completely unserved figure.
100%. And I'm going to be honest, I think a lot of it is to do with the erasure of Black women, to be honest. I think what... And the sad thing is that, so I've done, so while I was looking through Molly Hunt's archives, she was a part of large amount of organisations, on their advisory boards, on their, you know, she in her archives, there were, you know, a large amount of minutes that she was mentioned in, or, you know, apologies, I couldn't be there, et cetera, et cetera. And this was one of the organisations that she was a part of, was the National Association for Multiracial Education, or NAME. And she was also part of the Association for the Teaching of Caribbean African Literature, which is ATCAL. And a variety of many other organisations, at varying periods of her life. And when I was looking through archives for different organisations that I knew she was a part of because it was in her archive and her name was mentioned. She's actually not in any of those archives. Her name isn't actually in there. But it seemed like a lot of her male counterparts were. So I think a lot of it is to do with the rage of black women, I think. And I think as a society, we have a tendency to kind of forget that a lot of women were also very much a part of, behind, helped organise and kind of, you know, kept the organisation together and in order alongside the men who were also part of these organisations and also setting up a lot of these things. And it's just, it's for me, it's just a shame that, you know, her name isn't all over the place as it should be, because it should be. And so that's why for me, in some ways, I guess it's my life mission to kind of get her name out there and make sure everybody knows who she was, how amazing she was, all the work that she did. And also how rich her archives are, you know, because her archives isn't just, you know, the work that she did, the organizations that she created. It's you know, diaries, it's audiovisual material, it's, you know, hundreds of hours of cassette tapes that she recorded. Like, for example, during the 80s and 90s, she recorded LBC programs.
Oh, wow.
So they used to have a section where they would get call-ins from the audience around, with a therapist.
Mm.
Well, they would call in and say, well, you know, I'm having this problem. My family's having this problem. I'm worried about my child in this way. And a therapist would kind of talk through it with them.
Yeah.
On the radio, on LBC. And she would kind of record those sessions.
Yeah.
Whether probably likely to kind of come back to them and kind of analyse them a bit and that kind of thing. But it was just those kind of things. And kind of she recorded the day that Princess Diana passed.
Oh, wow.
And the cassette tapes, and we kind of know we kind of understand why as a community, and just, you know, conversations that she had with her friends. There's an interview where she talks, basically relays her life story to a friend and a family member, and it's just so rich. And it's also just conversations with people she worked with,
yeah,
which really gives us an insight into the education system in the 70s and 80s that we might not get any other way.
Yeah.
So it's just so rich, and I just feel like it's so important to kind of really look back at history and try and learn something and kind of understand sometimes, unfortunately, that a lot of things haven't actually changed.
No, absolutely.
And to be able to actually understand how we can hopefully continue to kind of move along change in some ways.
Definitely. I think you made a great point about the fact that, you know, it's not just about her life that you'll find things out in her archive. And that's, I'll be honest, as the researcher, as a historian, that's my annoying thing about archives. Because, like, if I want to know something about something, let's say, I can't just go to the something archive. Now, I've got to probably look around wider themes, the decades, the city, the area, to find out my scraps of info. It's like you're a detective. Honestly, archives make me feel like a detective. It's kind of why I prefer. Oral history is kind of detective work as well. You're doing your interrogations in a very ethical and respectful way. But yeah, it's like detective work. And as you said, like, if we were looking for more of Molly Hunt, you could look for her in... Well, now you know what other organisation she's in based on her archive. You could then go to their archives to find more about her. And then I'm sure through there you could find a web of people that have all worked on similar things and flesh out this network of educationalists in the 1970s or 80s. But, like, that's a lot of work. And it's important work.
Yeah.
And it's really cool work. And don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining about the work. But it also speaks to the really important role you do as an archivist. And, you know, my kind of narrow experiences in the archives in Britain and even in the Caribbean. I honestly salute you with the highest degree of salutation. Is that even a word? Because, like, honestly, like, you know so much and you know where things are. And, you like, I go there sometimes to archives. I'm like, oh, I'm just doing things about education. And they're like, all right, here's this, 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 and this. And then they recommend more boxes of things. And I'm like, how do you even remember where everything's kept? Like, and I know it's all about creating good systems in the archive and, you know, guides and all those things. But I just think it's absolutely incredible work that you do as an archivist. Mm-hmm. And to all the archivists out there, like, my hat's off to you all, to be honest. Yeah. You're working with Stuart Hall's archives.
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? And yeah, another more well-known but incredible individual that we should probably even know more about, because with Stuart Hall, I find even if you know a small thing about him, there's like that's literally the surface of like an iceberg, and you know nothing basically. Even if you know him entirely, you know nothing.
Definitely. So I'm currently the archivist of the Stuart Hall Archive collection at the Cadbury Research Library at the University of Birmingham. Yes. Sorry, but Birmingham.
Birmingham.
I know. I've been told a few times that Londoners say Birmingham wrong.
You do.
And I've been thinking about it a lot lately as a result.
I'm glad.
Birmingham. Birmingham? Birmingham.
We can accept Birmingham. We can accept, but like, if you want to be a true local, Birmingham.
Birmingham. Birmingham. At the University of Birmingham.
Nice.
Shout out to all the Brummies out there. Sorry that I butchered your hometown. I'm really sorry. But, yes, so I'm currently the archivist. Stuart Hall Archive was originally deposited by Catherine Hall, who's Stuart Hall's widow, in 2018. But a small amount of his archives had actually been deposited in 2011, 2013 and 2016. Mm-hmm. A few boxes of material was also deposited by Catherine Hall last year in November in 2023.
Yeah.
So now there's about 102 boxes when there was originally about 88, 89
yeah.
boxes. So the Stuart Hall archive is kind of within kind of a project, the Stuart Hall Archive Project, which began in 2023. And the project is kind of about multidisciplinary research and expanding the public engagement and the understanding of Stuart Hall's work. So it's set, it's broken down into kind of three different strands. So there's conjunctures, which is kind of thinking more about kind of public engagement, outreach, and extending to the Caribbean and thinking about kind of the diaspora, minoritized communities, and kind of posing new questions about Stuart Hall's work. And that's led by Professor Pat Noxolo and Dr. Rita Gale.
Nice.
Then there's dialogues, which is more about digitizing parts of the archive and developing kind of new ways to think about how we engage with Stuart Hall's materials, whether that is, you know, physically or digitally, and kind of thinking about kind of Hall's historical relevance and kind of continued relevance. And that's led by Rebecca Roach and Katie Parsons.
Nice.
And then finally, there's the reading strand, which is to kind of recover unpublished or kind of underappreciated works of Stuart Hall from his archives and thinking about kind of like thinking about Hall's work in more of kind of intellectual, in thinking about intellectually and kind of in terms of politics and kind of political formations. And that is led by Nick Beach.
Nice.
So I'm the archivist sorting out Stuart Hall's archive and cataloguing and making it accessible, and also kind of jumping between these three different strands, and kind of adding my expertise in terms of the archive to those three different strands. And I've only been on this project since December 2023. So obviously I'm quite new, but I'm learning a lot. It's very different to the other archives that I've worked on previously. In some ways there's a lot more riding on its actual accessibility into the wider society, really. And I've kind of learned a lot more about kind of my own work and the way that I work in terms of practically as an archivist. And I'm also working a lot more within academia, so I'm kind of learning a bit more about academia as well. And also talking to a lot of people who knew Stuart Hall, who were friends with Stuart Hall, who were very good friends with Stuart Hall, and kind of learning a lot more about him through them and kind of through their eyes, which I think is also something that I have never really had, and something that I think has actually been really valuable to me. But the project is constant. That everybody on the project is doing amazing things. For example, there's going to be a blue plaque that's going to be erected on the university campus, I think later this month.
Okay.
So that will be really, really lovely. And there's loads and loads of events happening all the time. So I'd recommend going to the Stuart Hall Archive Project website.
That's amazing. I think, as you said, like, maybe because we already know so much about Stuart Hall, and he's such a beloved figure through his work, you know, his life and everything else, that there will be more riding on it than. And I wonder if you want to talk more about the difference on working, say, with like Molly Hunt's archive, where, you know, you're kind of introducing her to the world, whereas with Stuart Hall's, you're having to introduce more of him to the world, essentially, but as you said, in a way to make it more accessible. You're in an academic setting, you know, working with people that actually knew him. If you misrepresent him, someone probably will say, actually, you know, he wasn't that way, or not that you can, you know, potentially do that much to misrepresent him. But yeah, I don't know if you want to speak to the difference in working on the two a little bit more.
Well, I think there are obviously a few differences in terms of the fact that people know who Stuart Hall is compared to Molly Hunt. So in some ways that adds extra kind of, it's actually quite beneficial to me in some ways, because it means that, you know, I can say I'm working on this individual's archive, and therefore, you know, that there are ways in which I can navigate, you know, I can navigate the university in some ways to be able to say, you know, we want to sort out this and I want to sort out that, you know, this is an archive that is very important to not just Birmingham, but also people studying various subjects across the world. And therefore, you know, the kind of support that I need for this project is quite a lot larger than most archivists get in projects, to be quite honest with you, which I'm very, very grateful for. And there's a really large pool of expertise of people who are helping with this project, so I'm really, really grateful for. But also, I find that people are just really grateful to me for kind of doing this work, which I've never actually had, you know, people say to me, oh my gosh, I'm so happy, you know, for your presence here, kind of you, you know, doing this kind of labor, like, you know, I've never had someone say that to me as an archivist. And it's really interesting, but quite daunting in some ways.
Okay.
But I think there's also the kind of the side where it's like, lots of people know who this individual is.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of pressure on me to be able to actually bring out specific types of information within the archive to be able to make sure that people can actually access it in a specific type of way.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it's very important that this archive is accessible to everybody, because at the end of the day, this archive is going to be crucial and important to lots of different people forever, really. Yeah. To be quite honest with you, people are still going to be citing Stuart Hall well after I'm gone, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
And to be able to make sure that, you know, not just academics and people at universities, but, you know, young people, people at school, up towards people who are, quite elderly, I think it's really important that I can put as much information, but also make it as accessible and easy to digest as possible when I present this archive to the general public. So I think that's kind of one of my key roles in kind of being the archivist of this archive.
Absolutely. And it really is a fascinating kind of role. As I've said, like, it is the kind of work that you're doing, to me, is it is something that should be thanked, and I'm very grateful for. So the person that said
I'll
that
stop
to you,
it.
I echo the sentiment. How you've kind of spoken, okay, I had a question about how future researchers might use it, but I think you've spoken to that really well. And as you said, making it accessible, so it's not just the academics that can read Stuart Hall or get a feeling of what he was like. I wanted to maybe kind of think a little bit more outside of, like, the individuals and what we can kind of learn from these, like, black collections. And as you said, I still don't think we're probably at a place where the archives are as rich as they could and should be with black life in Britain. Mm-hmm. Just let's take that as a kind of more specific thing. But what can we still, like, learn from these archives, and how important are they when it comes to black British history moving forwards?
I think the first thing that I would really emphasise when it comes to thinking about archives, and especially black archives, is that, unfortunately, they're likely to be very fragmented. And I've had a lot of people, you know, researchers, say to me, you know, it can be quite frustrating to look through an archive when you're coming into an archive with a specific mindset of what you're actually going to be able to see and what's actually within that archive. And you actually go in there and then you realize actually half the things that you thought would be in this archive is not there. And I think we need to make sure that we have the mindset that we are not going to get the whole of somebody's history in an archive.
Yeah, true.
And also, our own histories are very fragmented anyway.
Yes, also true.
Right? There are, whilst now, you know, we're all on social media, a lot of people get a lot of access to us at all times. When it comes to actual records, whether that's digital or not, there's still going to be parts of our lives that are not going to be clear or are not going to be as well documented as other parts. And I think that's the kind of mindset we need to have when we go into an archive as well, that especially if we're going into an archive about a specific a person or a figure or a group, we're not going to get a complete story.
Yeah.
We're not going to get a complete story of that person's life. And I think that's something that we kind of have to make peace with in some ways. I mean, as an archivist, I've very much made peace with it myself. But it's that kind of thing where it's like, we just have to remember that histories are fragmentary.
Yeah.
Archives are going to be fragmentary. And that's unfortunately the way things are likely to continue to be. Absolutely. Because we can't always get a full picture of somebody just from their records. Because that's unfortunately, that's not how things work.
Mm.
So I definitely say that as kind of my first point in terms of, like, the real fragmentation of archives. I would also say that archives are so important to really strengthening my identity.
Yes.
And also strengthening the identity of communities, right? And I'm talking about the LGBTQIA plus communities. I'm talking about black disabled communities. I'm talking older, younger communities that are from that have been in the care system, all kinds of things. I think by being able to access your archives and be able to understand that there are people who came before you who also went through the same thing that you did at various points in time can be so helpful and so kind of enriching in being able to kind of truly understand the way that things used to work and the way that things work now and kind of celebrating ourselves and our histories. I think it's so important to be able to actually go to an archive and say, okay, I want to look at this. This is really important. And actually being able to find something that maybe you weren't expecting to find and it really resonating with you. I think that's something that that can really happen in an archive. And I think sometimes we kind of forget.
But I wondered, Rebecca, before I let you go, for the average person, because we've spoken so much about archives today, and some people might still be wondering, like, well, what exactly is an archive? Like, how do I just go? Because you don't just pull up one day and say, I'm here, give me the papers. You know, what happens and what preparations does the average person have to do to go?
One of the main things that I would say is to get a card, usually most archives you have to get a
reader card,
to be able to access the archives and have a look at various histories. So if you have kind of a local history archive, whether that's a London borough, so like Brent Archives or Croydon Archives or Lewisham Archives or usually it's like local history centres and various things like that. But if you Lambeth Archives, for example, they have really lovely histories at Lambeth Archives. I would say give them a call, give them an email, or go there and get registered for a card. And then once you have that card, you should be able to peruse their archives. And usually a lot of these archives also have libraries attached to them, or books that they've collected, or journals that they have that you can also have a look at. I would say search for an archive in your area. There's also museum archives as well, that lots of different museums have their own archives that you can also look through as well. So yeah, I would say get in contact with them. If you don't want to call them, I'd say email them. If you can't get through to email, I would say go there. But obviously, I understand lots of people don't necessarily want to talk face to face with a lot of people, and I completely understand that. But so definitely recommend getting a reader's card. And then once you've got that, you have the power to go and look through the archives and really see what you want to see and understand your own histories and understand your own heritage, really. Mm. And that's what I would kind of really recommend.
Absolutely. And as a researcher, just ask questions, The archivists, as we can see from Rebecca today, they're very knowledgeable. They know lots of things. And if they can't answer your question, they can point you in the direction where you can answer it yourself. And that's one thing I've noticed.
Exactly.
About archivists.
And a lot of archives, if they don't have the answer, they will make sure they signpost you to an archive that does.
Yeah.
Or a museum or an institution. So, yeah, that's...
Really exciting. I think it's very exciting work that you do. I don't have any other questions for you today. I wonder if there's anything else you wanted to share or leave us with before we sign this episode off.
This is a quote from Stuart Hall's Constituting an Archive, and it says, "The most important things an archive can do is to ask or allow us to interrogate those moments of transition, because they are often also the moments of high creativity, and we cannot see from our privileged position where these ruptures are most likely to occur or in what direction they're likely to lead.
Mm. Wow. I think there's some thoughts for us to leave the listeners with today. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for sharing that with us and for being on this episode. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Really, 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 really grateful. So thank you so much
for your work. It is all incredible. And yes, I think we are all better for knowing more about Molly Hunt and knowing more about how we 100%. Can access our own histories and histories that we're just interested in and might be of our area mm-hmm. or of things that we like and work in and do. So yeah. Find your local archive and get a reader card. And also, you getting a reader card, just like with libraries, you getting a library card keeps them in business because they are seen to be important because, you know, all these things like sign-ups are measured. So, mm-hmm. having an interest in these things, it does wonders for heritage and for this work to continue. So, you know, even though you're not paying for membership cards or anything like that, you kind of being a foot in the door is really helpful. So do that. Before we go, Rebecca, do you want to share your socials with our listeners? They can keep up with any work that you're doing. I know you said the blue plaque unveiling of Stuart Hall's plaque at the University of Birmingham. I think that's the 26th of September. I'm sure you'll share things about that as well. So where can the people find you?
So if you want to find me, I'm on Instagram at Rebecca at Archivy. It's a very strange name, but I can put it in the notes or whatever. I'm also sure. Yeah, Rebecca Archivist on Twitter. I also run the social media for the Stuart Hall Instagram. Brilliant. So yeah, if you want to contact me or follow me or anything like that, feel free.
Brilliant. That will all be in the show notes as well if you didn't catch any of those names or didn't type it quick enough. So look out for things that Rebecca is involved in and the work she's doing at Stuart Hall Archives.
Thank you so much,
Rebecca.
You have too. Thank you so much for having me.
Have a great week. Bye. Bye.